After the movie Free Willy became a hit, word got out that the star of the film, a killer whale named Keiko, was sick and still living in a tiny pool in a Mexican amusement park. Fans were outraged. Kids demanded his release. I'm Daniel Alarcón. From Serial Productions and the New York Times comes The Good Whale, a story about the wildly ambitious science experiment to return Keiko to the ocean. Listen to new episodes on Thursdays. Want early access to the whole show? Subscribe to The Times at nytimes.com/podcasts to listen on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Hey everyone, it's Michael. As you might have noticed, we're putting something different down our feed today. It's a recent episode of our New York Times podcast about books, hosted by Gilbert Cruz. In this particular episode, Gilbert speaks with the writer Robert Caro about his seminal, renowned nonfiction book, The Power Broker, which is now 50 years old. If you haven't read it, and there's no reason to be embarrassed if you haven't, it's the story of Robert Moses, who shaped New York City. But as the many people who are obsessed with The Power Broker can tell you, it's a singular fable of politics and power in the United States. It's an incredible story and an incredible book. Okay, here's Gilbert with Robert Caro on the New York Times Book Review podcast. Take a listen.
I'm Gilbert Cruz, editor of the New York Times Book Review, and this is the Book Review podcast. This week, I'm joined by a modern master of biography and history writing, Mr. Robert Caro. He has written 4 volumes of The Years of Lyndon Johnson, a multi-book work on the life of the 36th President of the United States. Volume 3, Master of the Senate, won the Pulitzer Prize. Volume 4, Passage of Power, appeared on our recent list of the best books of the 21st century so far. Before all that, however, in September 1974, 50 years ago, he published The Power Broker, a book about the man who built modern New York City, Robert Moses. Robert Moses built beaches and parkways. He built bridges and expressways. He built Lincoln Center and Shea Stadium and the United Nations headquarters. Robert Caro built The Power Broker, a book both titanic in length and scope, and one that continues to be read and discussed and obsessed over to this very day. Robert Caro, welcome back to the Book Review podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, Mr. Caro, and I'm going to call you Bob because we just discussed what I should call you. I don't want to necessarily go through a summary of the book. I want to go through a summary of who Robert Moses is. I think if people are listening to this interview, they've read it, or maybe they've seen the documentary Turn Every Page from a few years ago about you and Bob Gottlieb. Hopefully I'm not going to ask you to say things about Robert Moses that you've been saying for the past half century, but 50 years is significant. I would argue that nonfiction, biography, history, a lot of it doesn't stand the test of time in that way, but The Power Broker has. And I'm wondering why you think it has lasted as this own monument in its way for so long, 50 years.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I've been thinking about that. I think people are interested in power. This is a particular kind of power. Robert Moses's power was unchecked power. We all live in a democracy where we think that power comes from our votes at the ballot box. Here was a man who was never elected to anything, and he held on to power for 44 years, almost half a century. And with the power, this man who wasn't elected to anything shaped New York and its surrounding suburbs. So I think if you're interested in government, you have to say, as I said, maybe 55 years ago when I started this, how did he do it? What happened here? No one even, I have to say, when I started this book, I don't think there was any real awareness, even among mayors and council members and governors, of where this power came from.
Do you have a sense, this book being 50 years old, that people that go into government read it and have read it? I know that many journalists pick it up early in their careers because it is such a sort of impressive achievement in reporting and writing. But when it comes to people in government, do you talk to congresspeople and senators and state representatives who say, I read The Power Broker when I was 25.
Yes, to be honest with you.
And what is their takeaway?
They're very complimentary about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think over and over I hear people say, you're making me say boastful things. I've never read anything like it. You've explained to me where power comes from, a particular kind of power. Now that kind of thing. Of course, very wonderful to me to hear it. And I think a lot of the things that I learned in the book still hold very true today.
You have written so much about power, whether it's in this book or over the many volumes of your Lyndon Johnson biography, and said in a Paris Review interview the following, and I love the way you put it, and I'd love for you to comment upon it further if you can. You said power doesn't always corrupt, and you can see it in the case of, for example, Al Smith or Sam Rayburn. There, power cleanses. But what power always does is reveal. Talk to me a little bit more about that.
When you're trying to get power, when you're climbing toward power, maybe there are things in you or ways that you're acting or to get power that if people knew about them, they would be turned off on you or they'd be afraid of you. But once you get the power, once you have it, then you can act or do whatever you intended to do all along. A really good example of that is Lyndon Johnson, who for 20 years voted with the South on every civil rights bill. He even voted against the bill that would have made lynching a federal crime. And then he becomes president. President Kennedy is assassinated. And he has to give a speech to Congress 4 days later. And he's not even in the Oval Office yet. He's still living down in Spring Valley. And he's going to bed. And downstairs, there are four of his speechwriters, his aides, working on the speech that he has to give to Congress and reveal what kind of president he's going to be. And he comes down and he says, basically, how are you doing? And they say, we're still not doing very well. But one thing we are all agreed on, don't make a priority out of civil rights. If you do that, the Southern senators who have the power in the Senate will do the same thing to you that they did to Kennedy and stop your entire congressional. And they say, it's a noble cause, one of them says, but it's not a cause that you should fight for. And Lyndon Johnson says, what's a presidency for then? And in the speech, he says, our first priority should be to pass Jack Kennedy's civil rights bill. And you say, if the Southern senators had for all those years knew how he felt, they would not have raised him to power. So it's really, in a way, I hope, a perfect example of what you asked me for.
Is it possible to rise to power, at least in our system of democracy, without that sort of veiled part of you, that shadow part of you, where you know some things that you believe, but you know that if you tell people too loudly, that you'll never get what you want, which is to be in charge?
It's a terrific question, and I can't answer it in the large sense for everybody. I know with Lyndon Johnson, it was absolutely necessary just to go in the Senate. When he comes to the Senate, well, I forget the year, but this is approximately right. There are 17 great standing committees of the Senate, and Southerners are chairman of 11 of them. They have the power. If they don't like you, you are not going anywhere in the Senate, and he wants to rise to power in the Senate. He cannot let them know, and he's a genius at concealing himself. And if you want to know just how much of a genius he is in this regard, the leader of the South is Richard Russell. My chapter is called "The Russell of the Russells of Georgia." They are a ruling family. And he asks the Secretary of the Senate, is a guy named Bobby Baker. He says, everybody else who comes to the Senate asks, what are the rules? Where do you sit? Lyndon Johnson only asks one question. Who has the power here? I had no trouble. I said, Richard Russell. Johnson doesn't ask for an important committee. He says, what's Russell's committee? He's chairman of armed services. Lyndon Johnson says, I'd like to be on armed services, because he knows that's the only way he can spend a lot of time with Richard Russell. He starts to stay late at the Senate because Russell is a bachelor, a very lonely man, and he stays late working. Now, Lyndon Johnson stays working with him. Richard Russell gets a hamburger late at night before he goes home. Lyndon Johnson gets a hamburger with him. Sunday breakfast, he invites Richard Russell over, or Sunday brunch more. He has two little girls. Russell is very wonderful with little children. He loves them. They love him. And soon they are very close. So Richard Russell is sitting there right in front of Lyndon Johnson when he's become president. And Lyndon Johnson says our first priority has to become civil rights. And afterwards, one of the senators, Southern senators, says to Richard Russell, what was that about? And Richard Russell says, a turncoat, if I ever saw one. So he concealed his feelings from the smartest of men for, I have to do it, from 1948 to 1964, for approximately 16 years.
I need to start staying late with my bosses is the lesson I'm taking away from that. You wrote, the book is 50 years old, The Power Broker. You wrote and reported it more than 50 years ago. I wonder if there's anything new that you have learned about Robert Moses since publishing the book. There's so much in this, but did you ever come across a new set of letters, a new archive, a new assistant?
Actually, no.
Wow. That's incredible. You tapped every resource.
You make me say boastful things, but no. The fact is, the answer to your question is honestly no. People keep sending me, I have a letter from Robert Moses. It's not that new material hasn't come, but nothing that would change anything of a significance.
You have an office that you walk to every day. You wear a jacket, you wear a tie, you go to your same office. The office is near Columbus Circle. In Columbus Circle used to be a building called the New York Coliseum that Robert Moses built. The New York Coliseum no longer exists. And I wonder if you ever thought about when it was finally time for that to come down, how even the things that the master builder builds, not everything can stand.
Oh, I thought about that a lot because I used to have an office there and I used to look down on the Coliseum. And I used to remember that Robert Moses used to say, my works will make me that's not a quote, but he used to say things that meant my works will make me immortal.
And I think he is, in a way, by the sheer number of works. Some of them will come down, you know, the Coliseum. Did he build Shea Stadium? I can't recall.
He was responsible.
Okay. Did Shea Stadium no longer exist? There are maybe a couple of other ones. But by and large, the lines that he etched into a piece of paper are still there. And for all I know, they'll be there forever.
And more than that, if I may say so, the shape, by which I mean the daily lives of New Yorkers. For example, we have a house in Eastern Long Island. So we started driving in to New York on a weekday night about 5:30, so rush hour. And at Port Jefferson, it started. Now, if you're commuting from Port Jefferson to Manhattan, it's about two and a half hours each way. That's 5 hours of your life every day, 25 hours a week, 1,000 hours a year, and the tiring hours. You get home tired. It didn't have to be this way. In the 1950s, when Robert Moses starts to build the Long Island Expressway, Long Island, Eastern Nassau, certainly all of Suffolk, is mainly farms. Land is really cheap. He is buying 70 miles of right-of-way, and he's buying 200 feet of it. And everybody is saying to him, this land is cheap now, but as soon as the expressway opens up, it's going to be crowded. You're not going to be able to buy the land cheaply then. You'll never be able to afford it. instead of buying 200 feet right of way, if you buy just 20 feet more, 240 feet instead of 200, that's enough to build a light rail line down the center of the expressway. And every 10 or 15 miles, since the land is so cheap, you can build a huge parking lot. So people who want to drive to New York or anywhere else on can drive. But if you don't want to, you can use rail lines. He's so afraid that this might, he refuses to do it. So they say, okay, if you won't build the light rail line, at least buy the 40 feet. Then in the future, someone can build it. He's so afraid that might happen that he doesn't buy the 40 feet. But he also builds the foundations of the expressway so light that light rail can never be put on it. So you say, I was driving into New York and I'm driving against however many miles it is to Port Jefferson, a solid lane of headlights coming out, people trapped in their cars, trapped every day. And I'm saying, it didn't have to be like this.
So let me ask you a question. So you live in New York, you're from New York. You understand now, following the writing of this book, how New York City works, in part because of the decisions that this one man made. Even all these years after writing The Power Broker, do you say to yourself, God damn you, Robert Moses, why do I have to be caught in traffic here because you did not want to put up this light rail?
I've never said it quite like that, but I have bored my wife by saying, you see all these cars? It didn't have to be this way. Yeah.
You have such a well-documented process, and I think people love to ask you about your process and talk to you about your process because it's so meticulous and reliable, and because clearly it results in good work. It results in some of the best pieces of biography and history of the past half century. But what do you think is the obsession with process when it comes to being a writer?
Well, I do get asked about it all the time, mostly with the feeling, I can see it in their eyes, schmuck.
What do you mean?
Everybody else, people ask me, I outline the whole book before I start writing, and then I outline each chapter as I get up to it in great detail, and then I write it in longhand, and then I'd have a lot of drafts. If you came to my office in the late afternoon, you'd see crumpled up pieces of paper all over the place. And then I type. So I use a computer now a lot to take notes because the Vietnam material in the Lyndon Johnson Library, it's just big. I need to do it, but I don't use a computer in the writing. Everybody thinks it's, aren't you slower? Couldn't you be faster? For me, it's more important to be slow. And it's not a blessing or anything I'm proud of.
Mm-hmm.
I just learned the hard way that things go better for me if I do it slowly.
I can understand that because everyone has to find their own way of writing. And I certainly have talked to people who say, I'm thinking with my hand. This is the way in which ideas and connections and particular words and transitions are coming to me. And if I did it on a computer or typewriter or something else, it just would not come out the same way. They can't explain why. They don't know what the connection is between their brain and their hand and the pencil and the paper, but that's just the way that it works.
Yes.
And I imagine that's true for you.
Yes. When I was a newspaper man, I was for a time a rewrite man at Newsday, and I was the fastest rewrite man. You know, at Newsday, then used to have 5 editions because they had an Out East edition, a Mid-Suffolk edition. And I'd sit there with my headphones on if there was a plane crash or something else, and I'd write 5 leads. I can write fast.
Mm-hmm.
When I started to do The Power Broker, I remember thinking, if you don't slow yourself down, this book isn't going to be any good. And that's what, I don't know exactly why I thought that, but now I realize that the way I am naturally is I write slowly.
Did you think, if you can cast your mind back to then, did you think that if I wrote this quickly in the way that maybe you are inherently built to do, you would, it would be sloppy, you would miss stuff, you wouldn't make certain connections. What was it?
I'll tell you one thing. You had to figure out what it was Robert Moses did. How did he get this power? That wasn't something that you learned. Gradually, people gave you hints as to creating the public authority and all. I remember reading the bill that he drafted to make himself chairman of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, which was the heart of his power. And I remember thinking, I'm not getting what he's doing in this bill. And it took me, I think that the bill was, it was very long. As I remember, it was like 40 pages long of small type. And I had to sit there, and then suddenly I said, oh, that's what he did. And a lot started to come clear for me then. And then you said, why did he want to do this or that? Or how did he think of Jones Beach, the great early things that he did? So you would go to his engineers and people who dealt, and say to them, listen, you talked about how he used to walk along the dunes here, and sometimes you'd go with him. What was he like? You'd ask these people over and over again, no, what was he like? What would he do? And you ask me, that's not a fast process. It's not even fast to get the person to realize, this young kid, Caro, he wants me to talk about what he looked like. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I want. That's what I wanted him to talk about. But it takes a long time. Sometimes you have to go back to the same person over and over again to get him to tell you what you really want to know. You keep asking me why things take so long. That's why they take so long.
We should do this podcast 3 more times and then we'll get the right answers. When did you know, or when do you know as an interviewer who, as part of your process, as you just said, you go back or you ask the same questions over and over again, you go back to people multiple times, you're asking for their time. When do you know, I need to back off, or I've asked this too many times, or they're getting annoyed, or...
Oh, they often get annoyed. Yeah. I can't stop because...
How do you know when you're pushing them to the point that's just before them saying, get out of here?
I'll give you an example of
sure,
that,
please.
If you want.
Please.
Yeah, on the Lyndon Johnson book, and not on the Power Broker. So he had an aide named Joe Califano. I think you probably know his name. And he was in the Oval Office a lot. Now, I'm trying to describe Lyndon Johnson in the Oval Office. And I'm asking Califano over and over. I have to describe him, right? I'd say, would he always be at the desk? And Califano would say, no. He'd be pacing around a lot. Then you say, what else would he do when he was pacing? You know, would he stop? And he said, well, he'd go over to the... Lyndon Johnson had 3 teletype machines, Associated Press, United Press, and Reuters, in the office, against one wall. And he said he'd go over and read the latest thing. And you'd say, what do you mean he'd read the latest thing? And basically the answer is, schmuck, I just told you he'd read the latest things.
Mm-hmm.
How did he read them? He just read them. So was he standing up when he was reading them? No, sometimes he was so anxious to see the last line that he'd kneel down and with both hands he'd take the piece of paper that was coming out of the machine and pull it towards him so he could read the last line. So maybe what I just told you, I may have been asking him questions for 3 or 4 interviews about that, about what he looked like. And it happens over and over again.
So that's an intimidating process for one who, for someone else who may want to write a biography or a piece of history, it's quite time consuming. And not only is it time consuming, but I think anyone who reads The Power Broker would agree that is also, as you have said many times, you tried to do a real piece of literary work. You know, it's not only the facts, it is the prose. It's not only the prose, but it's the style and the rhythm and the way that all of that fits together. And people talk time and again about the lists that you put in the intro, that you talk about taking that from the Iliad. And I'm wondering how long it takes you to find that right rhythm. How did you know when you're writing the Parkways that the parkways go in this order and they don't go in this order. And actually, the Hutchinson River Parkway goes here in the third sentence and not in the first sentence. How long does it take you to do this?
Long.
Yeah.
Long. That what you just, the example you gave, I said, nobody's going to read a book about Robert Moses. In fact, everybody told me nobody's going to read a book about Robert Moses. I said, I have to show them, I believe, that he shaped New York completely.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was shaping it with all his the different roads. And I said, how am I going to do that? You can't just say he built 627 miles of road. That's going to get no one to read the book. And you can't just say he built this parkway and then this parkway. That's boring. That's not going to get me either. And I thought, you just mentioned it, oh, I've seen a list of a lot of things, and it's in the Iliad. And I said, how did he do that? He listed, he showed the immensity of the siege of Troy by listing all the ships. I said, so I'll list all the parkways. So I remember typing this. I said, God, this is boring. You're just listing all the parkways. I said, but maybe there's a rhythm in this thing that will make people read it on and see the immensity of all the roads that he built. And I can't tell you, you asked in a way, very polite way, what takes my book so long. I can't tell you, but how many days really it took me to put the parkways and the expressways in a different in order. And I hoped that got people to feel the immensity of what this man did.
I certainly don't want to give the impression that all I'm curious about is why it takes you so long to write books. I'm asking about how you do it more than anything else. And the side effect of that is that it is time intensive, and clearly that has good results. But I'm not hammering you over how it takes you to write your books. It works for you, and I think it works for everyone that reads your book. I'm curious. He built the Major Deegan Expressway, the Van Wyck Expressway, the Sheridan Expressway, and the Bruckner Expressway. Is it you saying, no, actually, let me read it out loud with the Bruckner Expressway as the last one? I'm trying to picture you sitting down and almost as if a puzzle reworking these.
Yes, I'm reading. Then all of a sudden it came together in my mind what I wanted to do, how to do it. And it was very clear. The next morning I got up, or I think probably, I don't really remember, and wrote it out. And it seemed so simple to me, I couldn't understand why I didn't know it before. But I do think, Gil, if I can say, that things like rhythm are very important in nonfiction writing as well as in fiction writing. When we talk about literary things, we talk about it in terms of novels. You never hear it really, or very seldom, do you hear it talked about what makes a nonfiction book great. I believe that if you want people to read a piece of nonfiction, and if you want it to endure, the level of the writing, the prose, the rhythm, the word, the choice of words, getting the right word, is just as important in nonfiction books as it is in fiction books.
We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Swan. I'm a White House reporter for the New York Times. I have a pretty unsentimental view of what we do. Our job as reporters is to dig out information that powerful people don't want published, to take you into rooms that you would not otherwise have access to understand how some of the big decisions shaping our country are being made. And then, painstakingly, to go back and check with sources, check with public documents, make sure the information is correct. This is not something you can outsource to AI. There's no robot that can go and talk to someone who was in the Situation Room and find out what was really said. In order to get actually original information that's not public, that requires human sources, we actually need journalists to do that. So as you may have gathered from this long riff, I'm asking you to consider subscribing to the New York Times. Independent journalism is important, and without you, we simply can't do it.
Welcome back. This is the Book Review Podcast. I'm Gilbert Cruz, and I'm here with Robert Caro, author of The Power Broker. I think one of the great delights for anyone who has read at least one of your books was watching that documentary, Turn Every Page, that came out a few years ago. Just seeing your creative partner and sometimes foil, Robert Gottlieb, talk about the ways in which you approach this. And I'm curious, as someone who's written about power for so long, what were the power dynamics like between you and Mr. Gottlieb? Was it constantly shifting? Was it, from whence was the power derived?
Obviously, he had the power. He was the publisher.
You have the words.
I picked him as my editor because I saw he was the only guy I ever met who cared as much about writing as me. That did not mean we agreed about the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And we had terrible fights, really real fights over changes that he wanted. And maybe I didn't want to make, and I thought he was wrong. But you really felt, even in the worst of your findings, you felt that he was thinking about the same book as you were. And people keep asking me, the people at Knopf, some of them who would see these, hear the shouting and whatever, why did you keep him as an editor? He was not the kind of editor that if he thought a semicolon should be changed to a comma and you said no, you weren't going to turn the page to the next page. Oh, no. You were going to have to defend your choice. So that makes you, I felt, that makes you think about what you're doing. And I said, that's invaluable because otherwise, particularly when you become a little well-known, nobody questions you.
Right.
You need... I thought he was a very smart man, and you had to think through why you had done what you had done that he didn't like. Maybe you concluded he was wrong, but his arguments had to be dealt with.
So I imagine you could have seen a scenario in which you had another editor who, once you became the man who wrote The Power Broker, maybe they didn't push back as much because what do I know? He's Robert Caro, wrote The Power Broker. But to have someone who was so passionately engaged, both on a sort of wide structural level, but also on a minute word-to-word, punctuation-point-to-punctuation-point level, must have been everything, exciting and frustrating and energetic after you've sat alone in a room for all this time working on your own.
Yes, that's right, what you just said.
I'd love to ask you if you would love to talk about it, about one of your other key collaborators, your wonderful research partner.
Ina,
your wife, your longtime wife, who's been with you on this journey for this whole time. What has it been like to have her by your side in the hill country of Texas, in the LBJ archives, just with you the whole way?
I did The Power Broker for what I kiddingly at first said was the world's smallest advance. So we lived in I was a reporter, lived in a house on Long Island, totally out of money. And I came home one day and Ina was standing in the driveway and she said, "We sold the house today." I hadn't even known we were selling the house. So that got us enough money. It was before the real estate boom.
Mm-hmm.
We bought the house for $45,000 and we sold it for $70,000. So that's $25,000. That got us through 1 year. We moved to an apartment in the Bronx, but I had hardly started with the book. And it was very hard on her. She didn't tell me at the time that she had to keep changing stores because we ran up a bill, but she wasn't really a researcher then.
Mm-hmm.
What she mostly did on The Power Broker was typing. But then when we started the Johnson book, I came home one day and I said, we moved to a house on the edge of the hill country. And I said to her one day, I'm not understanding these people, the people of the hill country and the women of the hill country, because most of they were all widows. The men had mostly died.
Yeah.
And I said, we're going to have to move there. And she just said, great. And then I ran into, I couldn't get the women to talk to me. They had lived lives, if I take a moment, of such, you said, okay, here's a woman who was in high school class of Lyndon Johnson. You're going to interview her. So she agrees, after a lot of calls, to be interviewed. She said, and the directions are something like, you go 43 miles on Route 22, look out for the cattle crossing on the left, turn left, and then you go like 18 miles on a rutted thing. And at the end of it is a house. And you suddenly realize you haven't passed the house since you left the highway. And they didn't get telephones until the a lot of them, it varied for year by year, until the 1948, 47, 48. So they lived lives of what loneliness and isolation. They weren't used to talking to strange men, particularly someone from New York City with an accent, I suppose, like mine.
You have an accent?
So I said to Ina, could you try? And she revealed a real genius for interviewing. They weren't very friendly, so we had three fig trees on our property. So she made fig preserves. She learned how to make fig preserves, and she'd go with a jar of fig preserves to these women. And she came back with the most wonderful stories and understanding of the lives of these people that are now embodied in my book. And then I realized I have on my hands here a great researcher. And Bill Moyers won't talk to me. Mm-hmm. And it was important to me that he talk to me because for about 18 months, he was the person closest to Lyndon Johnson. Johnson regarded him almost as a son. So Ina is doing research in papers. And she does I sent her up to Theodore H. White, who wrote The Ranking of the President. He gave his papers to Boston University. So I asked Ina to go up and go through his papers. And she's gone for about 2 weeks. And I said, I think you've got everything you have to. And I remember Ina saying, I have the feeling that if I just keep going, there's something there. And she wouldn't come home. And as it turns out, David Halberstam, who Moyers did talk to at great length, had given his notes to Theodore H. White, and they were in Theodore H. White's papers. So although Bill Moyers won't talk to me, a lot of what he told David Halberstam is that, and Ina, I can't tell you, over and over again, she would say something like, I just have the feeling there's something else. And she's just great. Now, I can't talk about Ina without saying she turned out to be not only a great researcher, but a wonderful writer. She fell in love with France, mm-hmm. and she's written two books, The Road from the Past and Paris to the Past, about traveling around France and knowing its history and how much it adds to it. They're wonderful books. So I had to learn about Ina, who I had met when we were both very young, very gradually.
Does she, as much as you must talk about LBJ at home, is she like, all right, you have your thing, now let me tell you all about Fred's?
Yes. But we drive her. I'm her chauffeur in France.
Oh, very nice.
I drive her hundreds. My image of France is us being in a hotel in some remote place and being woken up by the rattle of maps. And there's Ina sitting with maps. And she says, 180 kilometers isn't too far to drive for lunches. So
this is how you pay her back for all the wonderful help she's given you over the years. One of the ways that you have been able to write these books is through looking through papers.
Yes.
I wonder often about the difficulty of what it will be like to write biography of modern people right now who don't have papers. You write emails, those emails, you write a letter over email that's sent to someone, they respond over email. There's no carbon, there's no trace of that anywhere.
Yeah, I think that's it. And you bring that up, no one mentions that. You just brought up what I think is a terribly significant thing. Like President Obama talks about his library being all digital. That sounds good, except someone has to decide what's digitized. Then someone's making the decision as to what they want you to see. I don't mean this as a,
nefariously.
I don't know what I think it's going to change history a lot. I can't tell you. The Johnson Library says they have 44 million documents. I think it's 45 million now. I can't tell you. You just make yourself sit there and say, I had an editor. My first editor is the guy who said, turn every page. I've never forgotten that. And the fact is that he was right. And I can't tell you how many times there are files in the Johnson Library. It's not very... not always very, they didn't keep a very good file system when he was in Congress. And that hasn't been improved over the years. And you say, oh, God, there's a file folder here called General Unarranged. And it's about 8 inches thick. And you say, this is going to take three weeks. And you say, that's 3 weeks of your life and you're getting older, Bob. Are you just wasting 3 weeks of your life? And I can't tell you how many times I've said to myself, no, turn every page. And I can't tell you how many times you find what you're looking for as you're going through this mass of stuff with nothing interesting in it. Suddenly what you're looking for is there.
I just keep thinking about how much focus it must take to be engaged in the file folder over 5 hours or whatever. And, you know, it's easy to get bored. And maybe that one moment you look away and you're turning a page and you miss something. You just you have to focus that entire time.
Yeah, that's the story. Yes. Yeah, I can't tell you how many times you say to yourself, schmuck. Or you say in a serious way, you're getting older. You won't finish these books. You've been on this chapter, looking at papers for 6 weeks now, you found nothing. Stop. And then you say, but John Connolly told you, see, at the beginning, everybody said Lyndon Johnson never wrote anything down. Now, John Connolly, who was later the governor of Texas, Secretary of Treasury, said, no, that's not always right. And I said, Lyndon Johnson rose to power because in the 1940 elections, when he's still, how old is he then, 29, he suddenly is the guy giving money out to congressmen. And I asked John, I said, do you think there's any rec, Secretary Connolly? Do you think there's any record of that? He said, oh yeah, there's something called John's Lists. Mm-hmm. I said, where are there? And I don't remember what he said, but he basically said something. Oh, I don't know. He stuffed it in these file folders called General Under. So I'm looking, as you said, and you got to keep your focus on it. And you're sick of it. You're sick of it. You've been doing it for 2 weeks now. And all of a sudden, there it is. The most amazing 4 pages stapled together. There are three. They're typed by John Connolly or by Johnson's other assistant, Walter Jenkins, in 1940, in October 1940, before the election. And they are lists of what congressmen are asking Lyndon Johnson to give them in money. So there are three typed columns. In the left-hand column is the name of the congressman. In the center column is what he needs the money for. Lyndon, I need poll watches. Or Lyndon, one more round of ads will do it. Give me 1,500. And then on the right, Connolly typed in how much they're asking for. The amounts are so small compared to $1,500 or something like that. But in the left-hand margin, in handwriting, Lyndon Johnson's handwriting is what he decided. Or if he was going to give them the full amount that they asked for, it was okay. If he was going to give them part of the amount, he'd write, okay, 500. But sometimes he'd write, no. And sometimes he'd write, no out. So I said to Connolly, what did no out mean? And I still remember he said, it meant he was never getting any money from Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon never forgave and he never forgot. Then you say, where did he get this money? Okay, So I said, I'm going through the rest of this file. And all of a sudden, many documents, it's on another file, also labeled General Unarranged, but in the same box. There's a telegram from George Brown of Brown and Root, the huge Texas contractors who were funding Lyndon Johnson and giving him the money for this Congress. And it said, Lyndon, the checks should have been received yesterday. And on the bottom, Johnson writes, I am not acknowledging any of these men, so tell them verbally, thank you. And there's a list of the men who gave each $5,000. And Johnson, it's either in his first term as congressman or in his second, I have to think for a second. He says he's never going to get power. He says it's too slow in Congress. Seniority counts, and he's the most junior congressman. But he thinks if a lot of money down in Texas, they want things from the federal government. They want the oil depletion allowance. They want contracts to build roads. I said, if I can get them to give the money through me and through nobody else, then I will have power. So I need two things. I need the money, which he got from Brown and Root, and I need the congressman to know they want the Texas money. They're going to have to come to me. And in one instant, Lyndon Johnson, junior as he is a force in Washington.
You tell those stories so well in your books, and you elicited that information so well because the way you write and the way that you interview people. And I want to end this interview by asking a question that has almost nothing to do with your books. You once said you took lessons from two of fiction's greatest interviewers, George Simignon's Inspector McGray and John Le Carré's George Smiley.
Yes.
And you talk about how Inspector McGray, I think he sits there, George Smiley wipes his glasses and waits for someone to spill their guts. I want to know, as we close this out, what you have and continue to read for pleasure. What are you reading when you're not spending 8 hours waiting for your eyes to fall out while you're looking through file folders?
The two that you mentioned, I read John Le Carré. I love him. And I love Simenon's Maigret. I found in later life, but I must say I found it through Ina also, Anthony Trollope, the 19th century British novelist. I majored in English literature at Princeton. We didn't read one book of Trollope's. Ina was doing research for me in the Truman Library. And she's staying in a boarding house out there, which kind of place where people left their books. And she said one night, I'm reading the greatest political novel I ever read. It's The Prime Minister by Anthony Trollope. I didn't believe that. But when she came back, I started reading it. And I said, it is a great. So I've now read 23 Trollope books.
Oh, my Lord. Robert Caro, 50th anniversary of The Power Broker. It continues to sit in works of nonfiction, works of history, and I'd argue works of literature as one of the greats of the past half century. It has been a delight to have you on the Book Review podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Robert Caro about his magnificent book, The Power Broker, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this fall. I'm Gilbert Cruz, editor of the New York Times Book Review. Thanks for listening.